Accession number 32379, reel 1.
How long is it going to be? Into?
40 minutes.
Good.
That's all right with you? Okay, so if you could just start off by giving me your name and date of birth.
It's Dennis Abditch, and 28th of the 2nd, 1977.
Okay, and can you tell me where you were born?
I was born in what was then former Yugoslavia, and in a town that now belongs is part of Croatia. But I lived all my life in Bosnia.
How come you came to be born in that bit of Yugoslavia?
Because where we lived, it's a town on the border with what now is border between Bosnia and Croatia, and where, because it was all one country anyway. My mum, the nearest hospital was, in fact, in Croatia. That's where I was born.
And what was the name of the town?
Karlovac.
And can you talk about your family a bit?
My mum is from the eastern part of Bosnia. My dad from the opposite corner, from the west. I've got two brothers. Had two brothers. One brother died. We lived in Bosnia until 1995, when we had to flee our town.
And growing up, would you describe yourself as Yugoslav?
Yes, definitely. Grew up in a communist regime, which wasn't really as bad as some people might want to make it. It was very... I'd consider it as a happy childhood. There was a lot of emphasis on respect to the institution, the state. For example, the teachers, the policemen. When you saw them on the street, you had to say hello and show a level of respect to them, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing, especially when you see things here. You know. Drunken women shouting at a police officer and hitting him is quite a bit of a shock, really, when you see that kind of stuff. So yeah, but it was definitely a happy childhood that I've had, but that's thanks to my parents and the way they brought me up.
Okay, and you would have said you were Yugoslav, would you also have said you were Bosnian, or was that not really?
No, I didn't really. I don't really, even to this day, I still don't understand the concept of nationality. For example, I still don't know the difference between British and English and Scottish and UK and Great Britain. I still don't get it. But when I was growing up, I definitely didn't see myself as a Bosnian. On my driving license even today says that I was Yugoslavian, which was what I was when I was born. So, and I didn't really agree with the separation, because once we separated, the bad things started happening. Okay. Everything before then was quite nice.
So it's a bit of a golden age looking back.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And it was the war broke out literally before I was entering my sort of 15, 16 years of age, which I thought was the really harsh, I suppose, that there's no nice time in your life for a war to happen, but it's just when you're supposed to go out and enjoy life, you know, outside the parent, you know, household environment, and none of that I could have had, because people decided to shoot at each other.
Were you brought up in a Muslim household?
Well, yes, now, but I wasn't aware of it at the time, because religion in Yugoslavia was secular. Nobody was there wasn't a ban on religion if you wanted to practice, but it was your choice. But I definitely wasn't aware what my religion was until after the war started.
So if we talk about the war breaking out in 1992,
yep.
What was your first, I mean obviously things were getting tense up until that time, but what was when did you first start realising it was really serious?
The first time I saw the that I realised that things are not good is was when the wars already broke out in Croatia, but because it was quite a distance away from, although we lived on the border with Croatia, that the actual fighting didn't happen anywhere, anywhere near there, that you don't really get to feel the effects of it until it sort of hits you. But I remember April 92, we were still in high school, which was supposed to finish in June, and then the government made a decision to end the school year then, and that's sort of the first hit. So the first thing that hit me is, well, something's not right here, you know, we shouldn't be finishing school now. And then the part of Croatia was at the time occupied by the Serb forces, and there were some refugees that couldn't get into the Croatian part of Croatia that was controlled by Croatians, so they had to go through Bosnia, so seeing refugees. And then shortly after, the UN forces arrived, and that was it, really. That was the, I mean, I was 15 at the time, so I didn't really understand why it was happening. I just knew something was happening.
So the Croats were already fighting the Serbs at that stage?
Yes, okay. Yeah. Well, Slovenia got separated, but that was all finished within a couple of weeks. Okay. The Yugoslav National Army just sort of decided to leave it, and they just left. But then in Croatia, because there was a mix, the proportion of Serbs and Croats is quite a significant number of Serbs, so those people felt the need that they need to represent their sort of views, and if you want to call it a religion, I don't really agree with this idea that the war happened because of religion. Working in procurement, everything seems to be revolving around money, and I still believe that to this day. But yeah, it was Croatia was war broke out in 91, I think. So there was fighting was happening already, even before the war hit Bosnia.
And Bosnia then declared independence, didn't it?
Yes, I think that was March 92.
Did that mean anything to you, really?
It meant absolutely nothing to me. I was a part of the education in former Yugoslavia was that communism would always teach you that, or it always used to teach kids like me that Tito and partisans and you know, were the good guys and Germans were the bad guys, and you sort of grow up like that, having certain beliefs, you know, what's right, what's wrong. And when the war broke out and when the independence was declared, I just didn't understand why we needed that, because two of my best friends were Serb, one Serb, one Croat, and we grew up together, and all of a sudden we can't, you know, there's this divide between us, which never really was there, you know, so I really saw it as a bad thing.
Okay, and you were inside Bosnia at that stage?
Yes,
Bosnia.
Yeah.
Okay, and when did the fighting come to your area?
No, because we made a deal with our neighbours that we're not going to shoot at them unless they don't shoot at us, and which worked quite well. We were surrounded by Serbs, there was a deal made that we weren't gonna, there was a ceasefire, and it was honoured by both sides.
That was the deal just in your town?
Yeah, yeah.
That's quite extraordinary.
Yes, because we were the, I don't know if you've heard of a Bihać pocket, completely surrounded by Serbs, but the only people that were actually fighting the Serbs were the southern, from the city of Bihać itself. They were fighting on the southern front with the Serbs, with the Bosnian Serbs, rather than the Serbs from Croatia, because most of that pocket was bordering with Croatia, not the part of Bosnia. So we didn't really, although we couldn't leave, we didn't have the freedom of, you know, I want to go to Zagreb or Ljubljana or somewhere, I'll go, you couldn't do it. But there, at least there was no fighting.
And was there propaganda against Bosnians?
There wasn't really any propaganda on a sort of large level. That's something that would reach people throughout Yugoslavia, because we didn't have electricity. That was all cut off in the summer of 92. But local radio station, there was, I suppose, an element of propaganda there. But because we weren't involved with fighting, the actual local town radio station I don't think it was taking it as seriously, to be honest. The whole war environment.
So there was no fighting in your town, but the electricity got cut off and you couldn't move.
Yeah.
So your quality of life was quite lowered by.
Yes, there was no school. But the interesting thing is people get by. I don't know how. I used to work as an interpreter for the British charity, and when we fled our town, 22,000 people on a 6 mile stretch of road with nothing around, and we lived there for 8 months, and the guy I work with said, you put 20,000 British people on this road within 2 hours, you know, half of them would be dead. And I was thinking about that, but I must say I don't agree with him, because you don't realise what you're capable of, how adaptable humans are, because you adapt to your environment. You can't expect the environment to change for you. So I'm sure that even my mum and dad, if somebody said to them 30 years ago, you know, you'll be living on the road for eight months, you know, through the winter, you know, where the snow is like 3 or 4 feet deep, you know, they'll say you're crazy. But you don't realise what you're capable of, and you know what you can do until something, you know, until you're asked to do it, really. So yeah, it was quite hard, but you get on, really. You get on by. You have to.
So why did you decide to leave your home? Because obviously things were getting worse, but there was no fighting. What happened?
The Bosnian, the central Bosnian government, that was mainly influenced by the Muslims in Sarajevo, they decided to have this Islamic state within Bosnia, which we never wanted, and we're the only Muslims that actually fought against the Muslim government in Sarajevo.
Being from your town?
Yeah. But the people from Bihać, they followed the central government. So they decided to start fighting us. We made a peace agreement with Serbs and Croats, and didn't want to fight anyone. But it wasn't in their interest to have a disunited or so ununited Muslim entity within Bosnia, so they decided to fight us, and we fought back. Main reasons for that was they employed Al Qaeda soldiers to come from Saudi Arabia or wherever they came from to train people how to kill people with guitar strings and that kind of stuff. You know, women that didn't that grew up just like any woman here did. You know, that they were telling them or paying them to walk around the street with their heads covered in scarves and all that kind of stuff. So we didn't agree with that, and that's why we decided to fight. But I'm not going to say unfortunately. Fortunately, we lost that war, because if we didn't, it would still be going on. and there'd be a lot of people dead. So we lost the war and we had to go.
So from the Western perception, Bosnians Muslims were all sort of together, and actually that's completely false.
That's completely false.
It was split. Okay. And it was just Bosnians from Bihać who were doing this?
Yes.
Okay. And how many of there were you?
There was about 100,000 people in the region, whereas maybe 30,000. We didn't agree with the central government. We just wanted to basically live in peace with everybody until the solution was made to the whole problem, not just in Bosnia but in the rest of the Balkans. But the way they the central government, the way they saw the whole situation, they wanted to make sure that people didn't allow for this separate entities, separate little states within Bosnia itself. I'm sorry, but that's what they have now. You know, they've got three governments, they've got three police forces, they've got everything that we said, let's have it for the time being, save some lives. But no, that wasn't allowed then, but all of a sudden now it's perfectly fine, and even when you look on a map you can see the borders within Bosnia quite clearly, and it just makes me slightly angry as to why the hell did we fight? Yeah. why did all these people die, you know, for nothing?
So how long did you fight for?
I was in the army for over 2 months, because I was, as soon as I reached the age of 18, I had to go to the army. There was no choice. The training was supposed to be for 6 months. I had training for 50 days, and I was on the front line for 24 days. Age 18, didn't have a clue of anything. Somebody gave you a gun and you're supposed to shoot at people. But yeah, luckily we lost that war. And that's probably the best thing that's happened.
So you went with your family, and you all left together, did you?
My family left before me because I was on the front line. I left with the army. The civilians sort of left the day before.
And where are you going to?
We were heading towards into Croatia, and we knew that I thought at the time that the area across the border was occupied by Serbs. But the big Croatian military operation happened on that day, so all the Serbs left. So that's basically when the Croatian army took control of the rest of that country.
Okay.
So it was really an empty. There was an area of sort of 40 kilometers between Bosnian border and Karlovac, where actually I was born. That was controlled by the Serbs. But when we fled our town, there was nobody there.
Where were you heading for?
We were heading towards Karlovac. Don't really know why, but I just knew that we had to really go somewhere, and Karlovac was the only sort of big place where you would head towards. I mean, even 18 years after I was born, I mean, my mum decided to go to give birth to me in that town. It was sort of almost like a point of reference. I can't really describe that, but because there's nothing around, it's just hills and forests and absolute middle of nowhere, you know, you need somewhere to be heading towards.
And your family left for there too?
Yeah.
Before you?
Yeah, but we were stopped by the Croatian army halfway between my town and Karlovac, and that's where we lived for 8 months.
And you found your family again, did you?
Yeah, found it there.
So you, what time of the year was this?
That was 7th of August, 95.
And can you talk a bit about what it was like living by a road?
It was a relief for me. I could finally take my uniform off. And I was just happy. Whatever happens, I know that I'm never going to pick up a gun again in my life. And as soon as I hear somebody shooting or something, I'm out. If war broke out in England, I'd be on the first plane, whatever, I'd walk out of this country. I will never let myself stay somewhere where there's potential of war happening. And that was just, that's the feeling I had, that was a relief. I don't have to worry about being shot anymore. I don't care about the food, I don't care about anything else. That was the only feeling I had.
And the Croats just didn't want you to move?
They didn't want us to move, but they didn't know what to do with us. So they just surrounded the camp. Our only hope was for the international community, for the UNHCR and Red Cross to come in. And for whatever reason, I don't know whether that's true as well. I know that I didn't see any international sort of agencies there for the first 3 or 4 days. And there are rumours that Croatians didn't allow them to come in or that kind of stuff. But eventually they did come in, and the refugee camp was recognised as a refugee camp by the UN. And then the UN, decided to get the, start evacuating people, wherever possible. Majority of people went to America.
So they evacuated straight from there, out of Croatia?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But they obviously had to find somewhere for people to go to. So most people, as I said, went to America, because that was the biggest. You had 20,000 people in one place. They all wanted to go somewhere. You can't expect Denmark of 3 million people to accept, such a big group in one go. But obviously in America things are slightly different. It was almost like a contract. We'll get you a flight. You'll pay off your debt to the state one day through the taxes and get a job and move on with the life. And out of 22,000 people that lived in my town, probably about 18 are now in America.
And why did the international community do this? Because there's all this sort of resistance to allowing people into countries. Why do you think they suddenly decided the only way to solve the problem?
Because they knew what the war was like between us. As you said earlier, it wasn't well known fact that there was conflicts between Muslims themselves, and those conflicts were more severe than any others. Maybe Srebrenica was an exception to that, but maybe Mostar. But it was quite severe, and it meant a lot.
So amongst people from your town, somewhere you'd fought against them?
Yeah. Well, the first, our next door neighbour burnt my house where I lived. Simple as that. They decided to follow the central government. They didn't agree with the view, let's live with these people in peace, let's not change our way of life, not have a religious state,
So you were actually more fearful of your Bosnian Muslim neighbours than Serbs and Croats?
Still am. I haven't been back home since that day, and I'm going to go at the end of this month. My cousin's getting married and he's asked me to be a best man. And it's safe. I'm not disputing the fact when everybody says nobody's going to say anything to you, but I have to drive past that house with the person that's burnt my house and threatened my mum to kill me and my brother. And I just find that a little bit scary, really.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been in that situation before, so I don't really know what to expect. That's what's the biggest problem with it, to be honest.
Okay. So how long were you in the refugee camp for?
Luckily I was there for 13 days. Because I worked, before I was sent to the army, I spoke a bit of English, so I worked with an agency called Feed the Children. They were based in Reading, in Berkshire. But I don't know whether they exist now, or whether they joined some other sort of big organisation. And I worked as an interpreter, and I had an ID card from the ECTF, which was European Community Task Force. But they made a mistake on the card. Generally, the interpreters, the local people, were given green cards. Maybe because of my name, which was Dennis, that they decided to give me a red one, which was given to the foreign staff, which was quite handy for me. A friend of mine drove me out of camp in the Feed the Children car, and I lived in Split for a while, which was in Dalmatia, with a view, just, I need to get out, and I applied to go out everywhere, America, Canada, Australia, you name it, every country that you can think of, I've applied to go there, and I managed to get into England, or UK, or Great Britain, whatever it's called.
So, where did your family go?
My family stayed in the camp, but because I was over 18, I sort of made the decision, I don't care, I want to go on my own, and that's what happened. So when I came to England, I was 19, and didn't know anyone.
So you're on your own as well?
Yeah, I came on my own.
So can you describe your first arrival in England? See, before you do that, what was your perception of England before you came?
Fifth grade, secondary school, first lesson in English, and I'll never forget it. I don't know why this stays in my head. There's a first sentence in the English book: there are many taxis in London. I don't know why there's a picture of a black cab, and I always thought, how strange, you know. Normally countries are famous for, they've got beautiful islands, mountains, that kind of stuff. And I always thought I need to go and see this, you know, before the war started. And luckily for me, I worked with a couple of guys from England for Feed the Children. So that's how I got it into my head that, you know, it would be good to go there. But I was applying in the UN office in Zagreb. I was applying to go anywhere, all the Scandinavian countries, and because of my age, I was 19, nobody was sort of even interested. They tended to accept families as a whole unit, but also dependent children within families. So if a couple had somebody who was over 18, they probably wouldn't be interested. I struggled a lot to get any response from anywhere. And one of the guys that I worked with, his dad is quite a successful businessman here. He owned a London Pride sightseeing company, buses. And then he said, well, I'll see what I can do. And he wrote a letter to the Home Office saying that if they let me come, he'll cover all the costs for my education, my job, if I want to do a job, and all that sort of thing. And I went to the British Embassy. That didn't get me anywhere. And after I got that letter, I didn't really know what to do. But I sort of ran out of options. Went to the UN office and managed to, this is so weird, the caseworker that I sort of bumped into knew my mum and dad from before, and he said, oh, come into my office and, you know, see what we can do. And he recognised me even from when I was a little kid. And then he said to me, you know, what's happening, you know, why are you still here? And then I told them all the problems what I'm having. And I told them about this letter that I received. And he goes, let me have a look at that letter. And he took a copy of it. And he said, I'll let you know. And I thought, here we go, there's another porcupine, you know, I'm never going to hear from him again. But the next day he phoned me and said, can you come into my office straight away? And in the end, I didn't need that letter. He managed to get me on a British Red Cross program called Bosnia 500. Basically, the British government decided to allow 500 people to come to England or to UK.